Welcome to the Public Morality. O.J. Simpson, one of the greatest running backs in NFL history, died recently. But he's best remembered not for running past defenders or through airports as a spokesperson for Hertz Rent-A-Car, but for the June 17, 1994 slow-speed car chase in a white Ford Bronco driven by his friend Al Collins, followed by the Los Angeles police. It was one of the most watched events in television history. It concluded with Simpson being arrested for the murders of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman. On October 3rd, 1995, a jury found Simpson not guilty of the murders. The aftermath of the case revealed America's complexities of race, privilege, celebrity, the judicial system, perceived inequities, law enforcement, as well as interracial marriage. The murder trial of O.J. Simpson became a cultural data point. Joining me to discuss the legacy of Simpson, we welcome back to the Public Morality, Professor Benjamin Davis. Professor Davis is chair of the Department of Multimedia Journalism at Morgan State University. Professor Benjamin Davis, welcome back to the Public Morality, sir.
Always glad to be here, Byron.
There is much about O.J. Simpson that we can talk about, but I want to begin with him as an athlete, because that sort of gets glossed over, because whatever happened after his playing days got washed, before his playing days, after, got washed away. Do you remember O.J. Simpson as a football player?
Oh, yes. I remember him as a player. I grew up in San Diego. We followed USC sports mainly because of him. And I have this image still of him on a Sports Illustrated cover, and there are these huge calves, and he was running with the football. And I always thought, I want my legs to be that big. I want my muscles to be that strong, at least my calf muscles. And I always had that image of him growing up. And when we would go outside to play football, someone had to be OJ. And of course, it ended up being everyone had to be OJ. I mean, we admired him to the sky. And followed him throughout his life, good and bad.
In the introduction, I define the Simpson trial as a cultural data point. I wonder how you saw that.
Oh, the trial was the breaking of the silence, is what it was. There was a massive silence, at least in the areas that I was working in journalism, and culturally among friends. No one really talked about that elephant in the room, which was race and ethnicity and white man, blonde woman. And what it did was it brought a lot of things out into the open instantly. All of a sudden, within a few seconds, you saw these emotions explode or deflate right in front of your eyes. And no one should have been surprised, because that's America. That's what we are. It just, someone pulled the veil away in a fraction of a second with a jury decision.
So, you know, it's almost like, where were you when JFK got shot?
Yeah.
Where were you doing the slow speed chase with the Los Angeles Police Department and with Al Collins driving the Bronco?
Let's see. I think I was actually... I was on the desk at ABC News in New York, and I believe also, you're going to have to correct me on this or do a great editing, but I think there was another, I think President Clinton was also speaking at the same time. He had an important speech up, and at one point there was a dual screen up with the president and OJ. But nevertheless, I was at work, and no one found it, you know, everyone was surprised what was going on. And there were predictions, oh, he's going to kill himself. That was the big word at the time. Oh, he's going to kill himself. He's not going to turn himself into police. But I believe I was on the desk at ABC News in New York.
You sort of touched on this earlier, but I'm going to come back to it, because Dave Zirin, writing for the Nation magazine, recently compared the Simpson trial to a Rorschach test. Depending on one's perspective, they saw something different. Talk about that, because no one saw the same thing.
Well, in terms of the trial or the...
Yeah, the trial. The trial itself. No one saw the same thing.
Yeah, no one saw the same thing at all. Let me tell you, what I saw... the detective Mark Furman, when I first saw him, my prejudices for police officers kicked in. And I know all cops are not bad, but if I'm going to stereotype a cop, my Rorschach test said bad cop. But I had friends who looked at him and said, oh, an upstanding citizen cop. Just as clear as day, we had different interpretations. And I think most of America was that way. And when I found out that he was associated with finding evidence for OJ, everything was suspicious. And I thought to myself, well, you know what? This jury, you know, some of them have the same cultural background as I do, and they'll probably think the same, they'll have the same prejudices as well. And I think that the Caucasians that I knew, they had a totally different perspective on it, just so different. And that's where the silence came in, because we knew what each other thought for the most part. But it seemed as if it was incumbent on the African-American to come out and say, oh, yes, he's definitely the murderer. Well, I suspected he was the murderer. I didn't know. And as far as I'm concerned, he is not, because the court of law did not convict him of that, regardless of all of the evidence that's out there. You know, I would have to have faith in this system, and I can't challenge it like some people tend to do these days. OJ is innocent of murdering his wife, regardless of what people feel, what they think. And there are folks who still declare that he's a murderer. Well, they don't know that. Nothing has proved that he is a murderer. And so the test for society is, are you going to believe what you want to believe, or are you going to have faith in the system? And I have to have faith in the system.
Well, see, and that sort of is the rub, because if you, there's a lot of doors by which way one can enter into the OJ trial. I mean, obviously, if your experience is one of domestic violence, you can go through that door. You're going to look at it a different way. If your experience is law and order, you can look at it that way. No matter which door you walk in, there's another door that we all had to deal with, you just touched on earlier, is race. So when you take all those things together, I mean, that's a lot for the country to try to make sense out of.
Yeah, it's what the country has to do is we have to look at ourselves. We have to ask ourselves, why does every conversation, not every conversation, but why does a conversation like this about OJ, why does it come down to race? And the answer is that race is embedded in this country and just about everything that we do. And interpretations, results will always have some race tinge to it. I think that you can, you know, OJ, I mean, he himself was part of his life from 13 when he first started playing football, and it was great. His life was America's duality with race. I mean, he learned early on this, Frantz Fanon, Blackface, White Mask, or W.E. Du Bois' double consciousness, that as an African-American, or Black, if you will, and as an African-American, you have to have these two different lives. You have to be the brother to the relatives and to the friends, and you have to be Mr. Clean to Caucasians and to corporate America. And he played that well throughout his life. But it's America. America is that way. We have, when it comes to race, we have different interpretations, and everybody has a facade that they prefer to put in front for people, and other facades that they, the other images that they want to preserve for friends and relatives. And it's something that I practice and try not be that way. And it's a hell of a challenge as an individual just to present yourself as you are to society, regardless of to whom you're talking. But OJ, his life was stuck somewhere, I would say stuck in the middle. I think he, at some point, he could not switch between being African-American and being in white culture. I think he was stuck there, and this trial tore at him, tore at his image. Oh no, you're African American now for sure, boy. The cops found a bloody glove.
Yeah, but
And
didn't he have that famous quote, "I'm not black, I'm OJ"?
yeah, right, exactly. Which that sort of goes to my point. Yeah, you are this thing. You're OJ somewhere stuck in the middle, and you're making all of the rest of America look at how we really are. And we can't be OJ. We can't be stuck in the middle. We have to choose. Especially when it came to the verdict, everyone pretty much was forced to choose amongst their peer groups, especially if there was color involved. You sort of had to up and say, yeah, he's guilty to your white friends. And to your black friends, you have to say, yeah, he's guilty. But you know that, I don't know that Mark Furman guy, though.
Right.
It's like, but let me tell you, my gut tells me that OJ did this, but the smart part of me says, you got to believe in this American system of justice. And I would tell people that in a heartbeat. But my gut also says this other thing. Hey, Ben, it's Mark Furman, you know, and these cops, these LA cops, they definitely wanted him. You never know. And nothing's going to change my thinking in that respect. Nothing.
Well, it certainly didn't help that the OJ trial was about what, a year, 2 years after the Rodney King videotapes.
Right.
And so this sort of tension is fresh, especially in the Los Angeles area. This tension's, it's always there, but it was sort of pronounced with Rodney King.
Right. And the jurors, believe me, they could feel it as well. I believe his jurors were not more than a few of them were from the Compton area, what they used to call South Central LA. And that told me right there, I said, uh-oh, you know what? I'm not saying the guy's going to walk, but he may walk. That was my suspicion from the very beginning. And everyone knows that you're not supposed to predict or try to read a jury because it's nearly impossible. But someone on that jury had a nephew or a son or a cousin who ran into a Mark Furman, without a doubt. Clean cut police officer who behind the scenes would was nothing but a suspected racist. And some of his language that came out in the trial clearly proved that he used language that racists use on a regular basis. And so that just cemented my prejudices against him. Not against police, against him.
Well, see, but see your last point that going back to the Rodney King. I mean, you think about it, the jury, their integrity was impugned for finding a not guilty verdict, but yet you didn't see the same type of angst when the police officers who had a trial in Simi Valley were allowed to walk. With the Rodney King verdict. So you didn't see that same type of animus in with pundits and commentary in the aftermath.
Well, the tribalism came full circle when it went to Simi Valley. It's like we're looking out for our own, and that it's wasn't a surprise at all. I think juries are a reflection of us, and we are sometimes divided on issues of race. We're uncomfortable on issues of race, and therefore we tend to retreat to areas that make us feel better. That doesn't make us racist. It makes us more human than anything. But the Simi Valley trial was tribalism taking place and looking out for their own, looking out for their police officers who are doing their duty. I mean, OJ was African American. At the end of the day, those guys are supposed to be guilty of something when it comes to the cops. Rodney King was guilty of something. They had to beat him that way for some reason. There's always that presumption when it comes to African American males. So he did something. I don't know what. What did Rodney King do? Did he drive 56 miles per hour instead of 50? He did something wrong. Did he raise his arm more than once when he should have just put him to his side and get beat to death, whatever? He did something wrong. Did he mouth off to the cops? Did he call the cops a bunch of white racists? Do we know what he? See, he did something wrong. This is what people were thinking. Well, you know what? OJ did something wrong. You know what? He's an African American male, and we know how we feel about these guys as a society. So he did something wrong. And that, yeah, he killed that woman. He killed his wife. That's the prejudice that is so deep in our nation makes us think things that aren't always true.
I want you to respond to the following statement. The Simpson trial created a mosaic of perspectives that all sides tried to fit in a binary paradigm of guilty versus not guilty, and it simply did not fit.
Didn't fit. It didn't fit at all. And it's like, no, it wasn't going to fit. No, you can't say guilty or not guilty is one way or the other. No, it's always, there's the caveat. You can't talk about the OJ trial and the verdict without getting to the caveats. For some people, and I say mainly Caucasian Americans, there's no caveat there. It's clear as day that he murdered this blonde woman. And it made people try to take sides, internally, personally, take sides. And at the end of the day, you really can't. There is no side unless you're, I have a buddy on Facebook, someone I've known since high school, and he was writing about, well, basically he just hated OJ's guts and how guilty OJ was and how much of a sleaze he was. And I'm thinking there's nothing in the world that would change his mind. Even if OJ had found someone that killed his wife, I think this guy would not have changed his mind because his dislike was for more than just OJ. It was for this, I think it's this image of this alpha male that some, that killed this blonde woman, Nicole. Sorry, I don't shouldn't just call her a blonde woman, but I think that we can't fit it isn't a black or white situation, no pun intended. It's like OJ himself. He wasn't on one side in the African American community totally, and he wasn't fully in the white side. He was ensconced someplace in the middle. But when it comes to society and the trial, they're saying, no, there are no OJ free tickets here. No one can declare themselves to be OJ. You have to be one or the other. And the caveat is that no, we're all OJs. We all want to say, but on the other hand, this, and on the other hand, that. We want that freedom. At the end of the day, though, we all have to accept what the jury says as being the law of the land, law of the community. But taking sides, I saw in the newsroom, you know what? I want to tell you something. I was very, very happy that I was not in the newsroom when the verdict was read. I was in the newsroom leading up to it and afterwards. But when it was read, I was like, boy, I'm glad I'm not in the newsroom now because I didn't want anyone to see me say, oh, he stuck it to them. That's what a lot of African Americans said was, oh, he got away with it. They got away with it for so long,
I want to stay with that
Yeah.
because I think you're raising a very, very important point. Explain how you can hold these two things, how you can, and as you said earlier, your gut, gun to your head. Yeah, he did something.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he got away with it. Now, how can you explain the historically how you can hold both those feelings? Because to me, they make sense. But if you would explain how you can hold both of those.
Well, let's say I'm going to explain this. Okay, so institutionally, the laws have been used to rob African Americans and my family personally, not only of wealth, but of other things, freedoms. The law and institutions took things away from us, and there was nothing we could do about it. And OJ found himself one of the best lawyers. You could call it a dream team if you want. He got this dream team. He got the money. He got the institution to get him what he wanted. And you looked at it like, oh, wow, the institution worked for me this time. The collective we. Whether he's guilty or not, he used the institution in this country to give him his freedom, give him what he wanted. It's like for so many years in this country, institutions gave Caucasian Americans what they wanted, whether it was right or wrong. And that stream flowed through me. I'm thinking, Ben, you can't think that way. The man probably killed his wife. I'm like, yeah, but you know what? He had the money. He made the system work for him with great lawyers. And the institution has a habit of doing things like this. It just ha so happens this time it's an African American male killing a white woman, supposedly killing a white woman, and getting away with it. And think about the reverse of that. Not too long ago, killing a white woman, if you're an African American male, you were definitely dead. You're going to be dead. And you wouldn't even get into a courtroom. He got into the courtroom. And I'm not supposed to be laughing about this, but in circles in African American barbershops, in living rooms and dining rooms, people laugh about this because they say, you know what? He outsmarted them. He spent more money than they did. And he got away with it. And that's what they used to do, by the way. And we couldn't do anything. So there's that attitude, that mentality that's flowing through your mind when they say not guilty. You say, oh, okay. Yeah, I could dig that. I'm like, well, I'm glad I'm not in the newsroom today because I couldn't dig it in the newsroom. I know where my colleague stood. We saw it coming. It was telegraphed totally, their attitudes, how they felt about OJ. So
You know,
I didn't want to even.
you said something else that's very important, and I want to come back to it because you and I are of the same generation, and it's a generation where stories are passed down. And so you hear these stories growing up, and sometimes you hear these stories of injustice. Where land has been appropriated or taken, land that may have had oil on it was taken. Those are very, very common stories that you hear. And you and I when as you were talking, I was thinking about, the Tulsa riots and Black Wall Street. Not a single person was arrested for that. So because one side doesn't have to know that history, I can see how one side can be perplexed to hear Benjamin Davis have this attitude. But this attitude wasn't about simply O.J. Simpson. This attitude was several generations of stories being handed down and a lived reality.
That's it. I mean, why is Ben Davis sitting over there in the corner smiling? Or why is he sitting over there in the newsroom smiling and the rest of us are pissed off? Well, what Ben Davis is thinking about is, well, you know what? The institution just sort of stuck it to you guys. But let me tell you a few stories about when the institution stuck it to my grandfather or to my father. And it's a type of story that needs to be shared with people. And I'm glad you're talking about it to the public now. But these type of stories have to be talked about. And I've talked to many, most of my Caucasian friends know about my story. They know that my grandfather had his oil property slowly taken away from him. My family had lots of property. And because of the minerals, there were devious ways of getting it from them. So these conversations, they need to take place. People need to know how African Americans feel about the OJ. I mean, it just shouldn't be silence. And they have to speak to us about how they feel about OJ. I have to tell you, the one part that really got to me with the OJ trial was leading up to it. Ron Goldman's father was calling all the media to try to talk to them about his son and get his side of the story. And this was at a point where no one was listening to his father. I can't remember his name, forgive me. But he called ABC and I got him on the phone.
Goldman.
Mr. Goldman. And I got him on the phone. I was talking to him, and he was just pleading with me for about an hour. He was talking about his son, how great his son was, and no one's looking at that, and no one seems to care that his son was basically gutted. And at the end of that conversation, all of these feelings I have about, OJ potentially sticking it to the system, I was thinking more about the human side of this, and I hurt so much for that man. And I somehow wanted him to become, he'll never be whole again, but to feel better about what the justice system would do for him at the end of the day. And I still had my own prejudices floating in that same little room of thought. But his father, Ron Goldman's father, touched my heart so much. He gave me a different side of the issue, which is really the father side, the family side, the human side. It had very little to do with institutional racism, fears that people have of African Americans. I believe in my heart there's not a racist bone in that man's body. It's just a personal story, a personal situation. And that part brought me back and made me get just a bit sober about what really happened here.
But it's a profoundly, what I'm hearing you say, Professor Davis, it's a profoundly American story in that one group looks at the OJ trial through a micro lens, and that micro lens says guilty, non-guilty. Then some of us look at it, I mean, I would certainly say I'm guilty of this as well, looking at it through a macro lens. It's not just a trial that occurred in 1995, but it's history. It's post-emancipation history, and we're looking at in that through that larger lens, and we see the interconnection to those events to things that happened, several decades back. So it's just, and we ha how do we learn? Is there a way that we can learn how to hold both those things in tension? Because it sounds like you had to hold both at one point. So how many as a collective can we hold those things in tension?
I don't know. I really don't know if we can. I believe if you look at the situation, the OJ situation, through a micro lens, it is an indication, acknowledgement that you have the privilege to do that, that you do not have to be concerned about all of the other reasons, reasons for doubt that other people, other ethnicities may have about the decision. I mean, it's a position of privilege to be able to look at it through a micro lens. It's a position in which you're saying, I have faith in the system. Therefore, I only have to stay focused on one thing, on two things. I don't have to worry about the therefores and the what ifs at all. But how many of us have that privilege? How many of us can drive down the street and not think twice sometimes about, what we're doing, our attitude, our license plate, our tags when you drive past a cop? That's a macro way of approaching life that we have to. We're not just driving down the street. We're not just looking at the red light. We're looking at a lot more. It's massive. It's macro. But the micro privilege says, hey, the light hasn't changed yet. I can get through this light okay. Don't even know there's a cop over there. Oh, what if my tags? I'm not thinking about my tags. It's a, if you look at the OJ situation from a micro perspective, it is an acknowledgement that you have privilege within your life. And from the macro perspective, it's taking advantage of the fact that we know that there are mitigating factors in the society that are baked in. I don't know if I answered your question there,
No,
but.
you did, because I was actually thinking about a group that that we meet on Mondays, in the late afternoon. We meet on Mondays at the Cigar Lounge, and one of the things that and it's five of us, and this just happens to be all African American men,
Oh, I want to go in there, man. I want to hang out with some brothers.
one of the things that was said was when I leave, one of the gentlemen said, when I leave the house, the moment I leave the house, I am on until I get home. He says, the reason I like coming here is because I can be around you guys and I don't have to be on. This is the only time when I'm not at home that I'm not on.
That's life. That is the normalcy of our lives. We
The
have to be here.
macro perspective.
The macro perspective. And the minute that you forget that, it's going to come up and bite you in the behind and give you a reality check in terms of, what this country is like, what this, the institutions may not be as strong and as visible as they used to be, but the institutional mentality still exists. There's still plenty of police officers out there, and there are plenty of bureaucrats out there who believe they have to preserve something, whether it be preserve the purity of Caucasian women or preserve a certain type of capitalist system. That type of institutional thinking is rampant in this country, and I think the only way that you make things better is that you have to have direct conversation or broad conversation in situations like this where you're reaching numbers of people. But it's always a conversation that's going to change things. It's just like Ron Goldman's father changed my thinking there on the spot. And but no, we have to be on all the time. We got to be on. And I gotta tell a story real quick. My
You
favorite Muppet
certainly
story.
can. You certainly
Okay,
can.
so I'm young. I think I was like 27, and I got the sports car that I wanted. I was driving across country, and I was in San Diego visiting mother, and I would be driving to Michigan for a fellowship at the University of Michigan. And mother knew that I was doing well, getting paid a little money. A nice sports car, single, didn't have to worry about wasn't tied down with a girlfriend. And so I was leaving San Diego. I was about to leave, and she told me, she said, "Now call me. I want you to call me every day before you stop to rest." Because the mother's mind is, "Son, I need you to stay macro-minded. I need you to be aware of who you are in a sports car. A nice sports car driving across this country." And all of these things from her background, my father's background, those horror stories, she didn't want me to forget that because I was getting paid a good piece of money. You're not Mr. Big now. People can bring you down quite easily. So I'm driving and didn't call mother at all. Didn't call her at all. And you know what? Back they had something called car phones. My students laugh when I tell them about car phones, but I had a car phone. I could have called her when I was on some stretch of highway. I didn't call mother at all. So I get to, I was about an hour away from Ann Arbor. I think it was about an hour. I just crossed the border, and the state trooper lights me up. I think I'm not speeding. I haven't done anything wrong. I said, "Oh man, I hope I'm not going to, I don't." All the mother's fears about to come true. Lights me up, pulls me over, comes over. He says, "Are you Benjamin Davis?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Call your mother." So, that's the type of mother I had, believe me. But she didn't want me to forget about the macro side of the society when you're an African American male. And to a degree, I did forget it. I really did. The only time I started thinking about it was when they lit me up, when the state trooper pulled me over. I'm thinking, "Oh, shoot." Okay. And I'm thinking, running through my mind, tags, warrants. They always ask about warrants. I'm trying to figure out what's a warrant. They always ask that. You have any warrants? That's the first thing they say. I'm like, "What's a warrant?"
I love that story because it says to me that your mother was like a precursor to social media. We can reach everybody now in just a matter of seconds. So she sort of was the forerunner to social media. That's great. That's a
And
great
I
story.
imagine her calling state troopers in every state, every city I was driving through, but they had me cold. For some reason, I don't. They had my license plate. I don't know the car description, but the guy pulled me over. And the thing about this trooper is he was so cool. He was like scolding me. He wasn't laughing at me. He was like scolding me, like, "Call your mother." Okay.
Well, that's that. I like that. It's a great story. I was thinking about the Simpson trial. One of the things that happened, and I definitely want to get your take on this. The defense in the Simpson trial pierced a lot of the Los Angeles Police Department's forensic evidence, raising concerns for some that the treatment of Simpson rivaled that of many people of color who did not have Simpson's resources to uncover such perceived missteps. That led to many being unfairly incarcerated. Is that a fair assessment? How did you read that part of the trial?
That the attack that the defense
That
put,
because Simpson had the resources to unpack, he had the resources to unpack some of the practices of the LA Police Department that a lot of young men of color did not have, and they're languishing behind bars versus Simpson walking free.
That's it was a statement to the brothers, the ones that were in jail, that basically who didn't have the resources to get a good lawyer to keep them out of jail, guilty or not. It was a statement to them. And Johnny Cochran, I think he was very well aware that that's what he was doing. He was sending out a message that this is not a unique situation here. These guys can contaminate evidence quite easily. Did you ever think about that, folks, in all of these other trials? And to tell you the thing about it, the truth about it is, I never really thought about evidence being contaminated and chain of custody until the Simpson trial. And I'm thinking, well, you know what? If I'm just some brother from Compton, is my lawyer going to have the resources to want to follow the chain of custody? Can he follow through on some of the things that Cochran's doing? I'm in trouble. I'm in deep trouble. I think a lot more people were thinking about how the judicial process works for people, rich people, poor people.
Well, that's something that we've talked on. There's a lot of aspects to this. We've talked about, the spousal abuse, the celebrity status, the race aspect. But what we haven't talked about, I mean, the another thing that the case unfolded was this two-tier justice system. There is a justice system for people with resources, and there's a justice system for people who do not have resources.
And it's the trial exposed that he had resources. I mean, that's the barbershop talk right there. Brother had resources. Brother had the money. He could buy his way out of this. He did, he really couldn't buy his way out, but he could get the lawyers that could get him out. And African Americans aren't often in that situation. Normally, you just have to accept you have to accept that you're going to, if you're a victim, you're going to be victimized by the institution itself. And OJ more or less said, you know what, the OJ situation said that there's hope here. If you have money, there's hope. If you don't have money, good luck.
But what I was saying about the OJ trial and the resources, when you I mean it, the trial occurred at a time when California was still invoking capital punishment. Very, very few people on capital punishment are people with resources. Capital punishment becomes something reserved for low-income people. And so I suspect if this was Pookie Simpson rather than OJ Simpson, this would have been a death penalty case.
He's a death penalty case. Because for one thing, no one would have paid attention to it. It just would have gone ahead and happened. And it's also the expectation that, Pookie did it. Those guys do that stuff. And it would have been a very fast process. And Johnny Cochran and OJ's bank account said, oh, no, this is going to be a very long process here. So I mean, the dual judicial system, it's real. And the trial brought it forth. And the trial said also to Americans, Caucasian Americans, that, you know what? These folks have reached a point now to where they can do what we did. We can buy our way to freedom. And it's a clarion call for those who don't want to think that African Americans have assets and the ability to play the games that Caucasian Americans have done and still do to this day, the ones who are wealthy, to employ the side of the judicial system that works for them. We have a former president that is an expert at that, making the judicial system work for him. Well, we'll see how overall successful he is, but it exists, and you can't ignore it because of the OJ trial. There are other trials as well, but that one crystallized it.
And yet, I'd be remiss if I didn't raise this. There's an undeniable irony here, in that the Simpson trial revealed so many of America's fissures. And at the same time, O.J. Simpson was never known as someone for speaking out on cultural issues. Like, O.J.'s not that guy. And it's sort of ironic that he's the guy that sort of unintentionally reveals all these fissures in the American narrative.
And the OJ could have spoken out on matters of sexuality, on gay issues. I mean, his father, I believe his father was gay, and his father died of AIDS. So there's so many other cultural issues that he could have spoken out on. Domestic violence, he could have addressed that as a beater, as he's suspected as a being. He could have become a reformed beater. There are issues other than race that he could have spoken out on. But for the brothers, getting too slap happy with the brothers couldn't jeopardize his income more than anything. And he started learning that from when he was a kid. That with these skills, you can become a very wealthy man, but you have to watch out who your friends are. I don't want you hanging down there at the corner in the 7-Eleven with so and so. Okay? They're not going to get you to USC. So I think it was very difficult for him to relate to African Americans that he didn't know very well and to their issues. If their issues were going to interfere with his income, no. And it's like sometimes you think about, was it Curt Flood who couldn't get all of the African American baseball players to support him in his quest for freedom from being traded? And he had plenty of support, but they couldn't come out in public and do it because they had to put food on the table for their families. They had to protect their families. Well, OJ had to protect his own income. And in protecting his income, he had to protect his image. And to protect his image, he had to keep a little distance from the brothers. It was okay to hang out with the Caucasians as much as he wanted and to get married to one as well. But no, he wasn't one of us until it came around to his being treated like one of us.
Till he became one of us.
Yes.
But it was sort of ironic because we began this conversation. I guess the OJ situation is filled with irony, but we began this conversation talking about OJ's playing days at USC. OJ came to USC in 1967, which was the same year that Bill Russell, Jim Brown, a young Lew Alcindor, still at UCLA, went to a press conference in support of Muhammad Ali not going to the draft. Now, OJ at the time had not become OJ, but even if he had, I don't see OJ Simpson attending that press conference.
Oh no, he wouldn't have. And the thing is, he wouldn't have called them later on or beforehand and say, "I'm really with you guys, but I have to protect something. I got to sign this contract, so I can't do it." He wouldn't have called them and said that. He just would not have shown up. Just I think he was singularly focused on OJ and OJ's prosperity. But no, he wasn't one of those brothers that would, tell you on the sly, "You know what, you guys have made the difference that helped me out. Your struggles, you're helping me. I just can't come up front and do it for various reasons." He wouldn't have done that. OJ was just like, "No, just let them go ahead. That's their thing. I got my thing, that's their thing." I think that was his attitude. It was all about protecting himself and what he wanted to accumulate in life.
So let's take someone like, Jim Brown. Same situation occurs. It's not, in my view, it's not the same cultural phenomenon because there may be an expectation that Jim Brown was not a nice guy. There was an expectation, a persona of O.J. Simpson that, and for some part of the culture, he let them down by his behavior. Is that accurate? How do you see that?
Yeah, well, I think he did let them down, those who didn't know him, just as Bill Cosby, quote unquote, let them down. But these are images that were created and they weren't real. OJ created an image of himself and he tried to protect it, just as Cosby created this image, whether it be through pudding, Jell-O pudding, and being Dr. Huxtable. These images, they weren't real. And when you start believing in things that aren't real, one day you realize you actually were looking at a mirage. Well, what is there then? And in OJ's case, what was there is it's us, what we wanted him to be, what society wanted him to be, what corporate America wanted him to be, what OJ wanted to be. I think that these guys. Well, in Jim Brown's case, I like Jim Brown because he basically reached a point where he said, I have a little change. I'm okay. I'll say what I want to say. I'll do what I want to do. Whether that's bravery that OJ had, and OJ did not have that type of bravery. Who knows if it was bravery on Jim Brown's part? Maybe he was just desperate and so angry that he didn't give a darn anymore. But we're forced in this society, if you want to succeed economically, especially, or within your office place, your workplace, you're forced to somehow create this mirage of what you believe in and who you are. And I desperately believe that you shouldn't be that way. And that's the way I carry my life. And I think more Americans should look at the OJ and even the Cosby situation and say, who were these guys really, and why didn't we see that, and why weren't they allowed to be them their bad selves?
You sort of touched on it a little bit in your last response, but I wanted to ask because the OJ trial was built on a foundation of tragedy. I mean, two people needlessly lost their lives. But when we think about the cultural aspect of that trial, is there anything positive that came out of it, or let me say a lesson learned or something that we could build on?
I think that, well, first of all, there's a personal side for me, which I told you already that my conversation with Ron Goldman's father made me think about the personal side of a tragedy like this, as opposed to societal interpretations and beliefs. I think that Americans should have been able to see this system, the judicial system, being two-tiered. The lessons, any positive lessons that could come out of a trial like this, no. If anything, it's just, I think it can spur conversation. It should get us talking across to each other as opposed to just talking to people within our own groups. And that's a reflection of even social media. People tend to go to social media sites that reflect, mirror what they already believe, and don't cross over. But this trial, and even today, the discussion of this trial should be one that's done in open. And I was about to respond to my buddy from high school about the OJ, what he said about OJ, just to get a conversation going. But I thought to myself, I said, not in text, not with words like this. This is not the place. I would rather do this in person. And I'll get that opportunity soon at a reunion.
Well, what about those of us in journalism? What was a lesson? Is there a lesson learned for us in journalism?
Yeah, make sure you're off. The days that in journalism, I think that what we have to do is we have to say, why isn't that Ben was wanted to be off that day? Well, I didn't want to be off. I just so happened to not be in the newsroom. Why did he feel so comfortable about it? Well, in journalism, we have to be comfortable with the uncomfortable. We have to accept what's nearly unacceptable. That's what we have to do. And we have to take it with a sense of duty. And not enough newsrooms are that way still. Not enough newsrooms have someone there that's going to speak up, feel comfortable speaking up and saying, you guys are looking at this story through the wrong lens here. You guys are not looking, you guys see a jury. In the OJ trial, I don't think anyone was saying to certain media executives, you guys see a jury. And you're seeing that jury through your micro lens. I see a jury through a macro lens. I see a jury that has a couple of ladies from Compton on it. And so I'm not, I don't expect this trial to turn out the way that you do. And yeah, I don't trust police officers, by the way. The only police officers I trust are the ones I know personally. But I don't have the luxury of trusting every police officer that's driving around out there. Every police officer is suspicious. These type of conversations have to take place in newsrooms. So news directors will understand that there's a perspective to a story that should
And I
be
take
brought.
your point about not trusting police officers.
Yeah.
I take your point about not trusting police officers, except for the one who stopped you on the side of the road in Michigan and said, call your mother. You trusted him. So
Oh,
that.
yeah. And my mother loves him too, by the way. Oh, man. God rest her soul. But no, I think the newsrooms, they still have to create more diversity. It's one thing to say, oh, yeah, we hired 45 African Americans. We have them on staff. We got that diversity. But do you have the diversity of thought? Do they feel comfortable enough to come up to you and tell you that an approach to a story is one that they should reconsider? And they can't do that if they feel as though their BMW and their great income or their ability to travel to a great job, great story, it's going to be in jeopardy because they're talking to you about something like that. I don't think all newsrooms have reached that sense of racial maturity yet.
Benjamin Davis, Professor, Chair, Morgan State University, sir, thank
That's
you
a,
for once
yeah.
again joining us on the Public Morality. The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at Byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, BYRON, at publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Prime, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Those listening to the Public Morality on WSNC can also listen on an app. Using your mobile device, simply go to your application page, search WSNC 90.5, and click open to listen from anywhere. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. For all of us at the Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.